So, do we do the announcements in the beginning, or do we do the announcements in the end?
Interesting.
It's about the email you sent?
Yeah. Two emails I sent. Should have gotten two notifications.
Yeah, I got them.
Yeah. The first one was I set the dates and all the parameters for the paper, because I realized I hadn't opened up your Engage show yet. And the second one was an announcement on when your exam will be, which is tomorrow. Like I said, you're doing it online, obviously not in class, so don't come. Someone else will be here, not us. It opens up at 8 a.m. in the morning, and it will remain open until midnight. So at some point tomorrow, give me an hour. That's all I ask. Whatever works for you, works for me. Now, a little bit of a warning. We all know that the Wi-Fi here is kind of wonky at times. So if you get kicked out of Engage for loss of Wi-Fi connection, you can't go back in. You'll be locked out. You have to go back and basically do it again. So if you get kicked out, send me an email, and I'll see how far you got, and then we'll go from there. All right. Will I be monitoring? I'm not going to be with my email open all day long, but I don't think I'm meeting with any clients tomorrow, so I'll probably be at home. So if something happens, you could probably count on hearing from me quicker than, you know, those of you who sent me emails on Thursday or Friday, and I'm just getting back to them. The other thing is the paper. As you know, almost all of you have submitted topics, and the topics have been approved. If you have not submitted your topics, well, you are late. And if I don't get them by this Friday, you'll have a penalty imposed on your paper. But I opened up where you're going to drop your paper in Engage. So you're going to write your paper, make sure you save it as a file, and then you will take that file and you'll drop it in the Dropbox. It will then scan it. I think college uses Verisite, so they'll look for plagiarism. They'll give you a report, and I'll get the report as well. And you're just going to make sure you finally submit it. But if you read what I put in the instructions, yes, the paper is due by April 22nd, which is a Tuesday. But if you are motivated and want to get this done quick, I'm giving you early submission bonuses. If I can get it by the end of this month, so you bang it out in the next 3 or 4 weeks, I will add plus 10 to your grade. If you get it in by the end of March, which is a month early, I will add plus 5. Why do I do this? Well, hardly anybody ever does it. Most students procrastinate and wait literally till like 11 o'clock at night to start writing it on the day it's due. But if you are one of those people that are well organized and just wants to get this off your plate, again, you should be able to do this in a weekend. You know, you are able to do so. But, before dropping it, make sure you go to the paper section of proflamanic.com. All the way through the instructions. Read it top to bottom, bottom to top, and then top to bottom again. Make sure you understand what I am requiring you to do on this assignment. Because I'm not exaggerating, and you can verify this for me because you've already done one, I don't grade it like an English professor. The assignment is based on following directions. You will lose points if you don't follow directions. But if you follow directions, even if you are a horrible writer, the most points you'll lose is 15 points. Because it got to grade you on spelling and grammar and all the rest. But the maximum penalty is minus 15. So if you follow all of the directions to the T, and even if you're a sucky writer, you still should be able to get a B. Now, do students fail the paper? Absolutely. But why do they fail it? They don't follow directions. So, as I say to my groups over and over and over again like a broken record, if there's something in the paper section that you do not understand, come to class and ask. I can guarantee you somebody else, if they were going through it, might have the same question. So by you asking in class, I'll be able to answer it for everybody. And then there'll be no doubt. And whatever potential penalty will be avoided. Now, if you are shy, it will come back to bite you, because there are a couple of things on there that I purposely made really hard to figure out. But if you put a little effort in, you'll be able to find the answers. But if you can't, professor, what do you mean by this? I will explain it. I promise. I don't keep things hidden. So if you ask, you will know. All right. So make sure you go over the paper instructions. Make sure you understand what you're doing with the paper so that way you all can get a good grade. And guys, I'm sorry I'm not repeating 5 minutes worth of stuff. So go on to the recording and listen to what you missed. Fredo. Deshaun, right? Oh. How the heck did I miss Dylan? Alright. But, for those of you who came late, your exam is tomorrow. Just FYI. But again, I explain. I'll make sure it gets up there as soon as possible. Or ask somebody. Alright, so the exam will encompass everything since day one up until the point where I say we're gonna stop. I'll be honest with you, I don't have a full class worth of information for your exam. So I'm gonna tell you where to put a line in, and then I'm gonna start the stuff for the second exam. But depending upon where I'm at, I won't go too far, so probably won't keep you in the whole class. We'll just see how things play out. This class is based on understanding how Europe took over the world. And for this first exam, we've seen the Spanish went into the New World, conquered it. The Portuguese penetrated the Asian trade network, but they opened the door because they weren't able to conquer it, but they opened the door for the Dutch and the English. Of course, the Dutch, while they would control trade routes like the Portuguese did, while they would make bases like the Portuguese would, in time, they would come over to take over real estate. But they weren't able to penetrate the places that had the great ancient civilizations. So they couldn't make inroads in India, nor China. But instead, they set their sights on Indonesia. And Indonesia is an archipelago made up of thousands of islands. Within 200 years, they managed to conquer all of them, bit by bit, step by step. Which was extraordinary. But at the same time the Dutch were taking over the islands, the British did something even more extraordinary. They would actually penetrate the subcontinent of India, homeland to the ancient Hindu civilization, and bit by bit, they would conquer it. Now, we're going to kind of do the spoilers, but when we get to exam two, we're going to start talking about an empire called the Mughals. The Mughals was a Muslim empire that built itself in and around 1500, and they had conquered most of the subcontinent. But by the time the British arrived, the Muslims were losing hold. So they controlled everything, but they were slowly retreating back. And as it turned out, who would help drive them out? The Brits. How did they do it? Well, I got one territory to talk about. How they would do it is almost identical to what the Dutch did, except India was made up of sub-kingdoms, tiny little regions that had been conquered in an empire. The leaders of these provinces were called Rajas. Again, they're kind of like kings or maybe lords or princes or dukes, whatever title you want to give them, but they were the sovereigns. Now, many of these Rajas had been put in place by the Mughals. Meaning, they were not Hindu like their people, but many of them were Muslims. So a lot of the Hindu people wanted to get rid of the Muslims, which in part is one of the reasons why those people trying to topple the Muslims would reach out to anyone who could help them, like the British. But the fascinating thing about the British is that when the British East India Company came in, one of the first things they did was start building a native army. Their soldiers were known as sepoys. So when I just use the generic the British, truth be told, 95% of the soldiers fighting are actually Indians. But they're Hindu Indians. And why did they sign up? Well, most of them were poor. They had no job opportunities. So by signing up, they got to wear a fancy uniform. They got to be trained in British tactics. And they would be given the right to travel to England if they wanted to. Plus, any of you ever play sports? You know, there's no better feeling than the first game of the season when you got your uniform on, it's nice and clean, and you're ready to go. You know, it's a good feeling. Well, soldiers generally feel the same thing. You get to walk around in a uniform. People look up to you. But one of the biggest differences between the British and the Dutch was that India was also desired by the French. So as the Brits fanned out, they found themselves often on the opposite side of the battlefield as locals supported by the French. And FYI, the English hated no one in the world more than the French. For hundreds of years. So this dynamic was also a competition. So as the English come and would eventually take over the subcontinent, they also celebrated victory after victory by driving the French out. So the easiest way to do it is to only to talk about one province. Because there are hundreds. I mean, this is a subcontinent. I know it's just a graphic right now. But geographically, it's about half the size of the continental United States. It's huge. We're talking hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles. And it was all divided up into tiny little provinces. But the easiest example to study is this province right there. That would be known as Bengal. Because this was really one of the first ones that they were the most successful in. All right. 1698. Representatives of the British East India Company. So like the Dutch, it wasn't the government coming over, but rather it was representatives of a private trading company. What were they motivated to get? Money. All businesses are motivated to get money. They didn't care about politics. They didn't care about religion. They just wanted goods. So they arrive. And they negotiate with the local governor, who was a governor of the Mughals, so the governor was a Muslim, and they negotiate for the right to establish a factory. Well, what the Nawab, who was the leader, what he ended up doing was he ended up giving to the British land rights to three small villages, all located inland on a river with a bay that had deep water. So there was a village on either side and one at the head. The Nawab said, you can take those. So the British East India Company came in. They did not drive the villagers out. No, they actually invited them to basically work for the company. They would build a factory, and they would begin trying to collect goods that they could put on ships and ship back to England. All right, nothing spectacular. For 40 years, 40 years, the Mughal Nawab, the ruler, allowed the British to expand their operations. And soon the three villages would be merged into a single city that would become Calcutta. Calcutta would see lots of revenue and it would become a trading stop on the Asian trade network. Soon ships as far away as Africa and North Korea, Korea, Japan, China, would be sailing into the harbor. The British would get spices from India and they would exchange in the marketplaces. Everything was going good until 1756. When a newly appointed Nawab, a local ruler, Siraj ul Dala, turned against the Brits. He didn't think it was right that the Brits were making so much money and basically giving him so little. So the French came in and gave him a better deal. So the Nawab basically decided, we're going to get rid of the British. French soldiers would join with the Muslim troops, and they would, in fact, drive the Brits out. All of the East India Company agents within the city would be arrested, and many people would lose their homes. So in response, the British East India Company would send word, and they would go around and collect little squads of soldiers from some of the other places they were just starting to penetrate. They would form an army of about 3,000, and they would attempt to actually battle the forces of the Nawab and their French allies. The Brits had about 3,000 troops. Good size army back then. But the Nawab was able to deploy 50,000 soldiers. That's almost outnumbered 20 to 1. That's insane. But Siraj was a beta male, not an alpha. He wasn't a war leader. So he basically gave full command to the French. Although, truth be told, the real powerhouse in the army was a Muslim noble by the name of Mir Jafar. How did they not lose? The commanding officer, sent by the British East India Company, was one Robert Clive. Clive had groveled, kowtowed, learned how business was done in India. He quickly learned about the tension that existed between the Muslims and the Hindus, and how many Hindus, who were the majority, did not like being controlled by the Muslims, who were the minority. So what does Clive do? Well, he sends agents, spies, into some of the villages and cities in and around Calcutta, and he makes deals with Hindu bankers who willingly gave him money in the hopes of them getting their freedom. He then took that money and basically bribed or bought Mir Jafar, the Muslim general who controlled the vast majority of soldiers in Siraj's army. That was huge. Because on the day the battle commenced, the French forces were arranged there, and some of Siraj's local forces were there. But Mir Jafar's army was on the flank. As the troops began to march, Mir Jafar's soldiers did not advance, and instead turned around and began marching off the battlefield. Well, none of you have ever fought in a war, so you don't understand what battlefield chaos is like. But the moment the bullets start flying, all hell breaks loose. So as Siraj's forces and the French are marching forward to the British lines, the British are up on a hill. They look like they're just standing there as soldiers. But just as the troops get in range, the British take off camouflage and show all of the cannon that they had. And they basically began opening fire. Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. 16-pound ball of lead flying at you at subsonic speed. If it hits you, it will turn wherever it hits you into a mass of jelly. The same with the guy behind you, and probably 10 deep. They decimated Siraj's forces. Well, then, as legend has it, Siraj loses his mind, goes to Mir Jafar's tent, starts confronting him over why he did that. Mir Jafar arrested Siraj and later personally beheaded him. Then, as a reward for his loyalty, the British East India Company names Mir Jafar to be the Raja of Bengal. And what's the quid pro quo? Well, you allow us to do business as we want to do business, we will give you our troops. We will keep you on the throne. Multiply that process by 100 over the next 100 years, province by province. That's how the British conquered the subcontinent of India. By putting puppets on the throne, although they were commonly referred to as British Rajas, which is an acknowledgement that they're not serving the people, they're serving the British. And of course, quid pro quo. In time, the company would be giving complete political and economic control over entire cities, over entire regions. Questions? Well, I don't know if you can see the different colors. But you can see, as I said, over the next 100 years, all broken up by time, province by province by province by province by province by province. Eventually, they would take over almost everything. Clashes grew so strong that eventually even the Mughal Empire was toppled. And then once in control, the Brits changed the economic map of India. Instead of trying to micromanage the entire subcontinent, they selected three cities: Calcutta, Madrasis, and Bombay. One there, one there, one there. these would become the major British ports. And in time, all of the ships doing the Asian trade network would start going to Calcutta, going to Madras, going to Bombay. And they would do business as they always did business. And then the profits would be used to buy commodities that England needed. FYI, by the time India was conquered, the United States had won its war for independence. England was dependent upon southern cotton. But then the U.S. had the Civil War. And during that war, Britain did not suffer a recession. Because instead of buying southern cotton, he started exporting in mass Indian cotton. Now, one of the most amazing things is how the heck did they do this? Well, it's the same way that the Europeans would conquer all of Africa 100 years later. The people of India had no national identity. They didn't view themselves as Indians. Instead, they identified themselves based on whatever province they lived in. So long as the local Raja seemed happy that the British were there, the government of the people was okay with it. So what did all the people say? We're okay with it. And the longer the British controlled, the more young men volunteered for the opportunities to work for either the British East India Company or to serve in the military forces. And by the beginning of the 20th century, India would actually become a pivot point in England's global empire. Particularly once the Suez Canal was made. It was now possible for English ships to surge all of these goods, all of these commodities through the Mediterranean up to England and into the global marketplace. And many of the battles that the British fought in China, in Africa, hell, even in World War I, were fought by Indian soldiers. Because this would become that important to the well-being of the empire. So they got men, they got resources like cotton, sugar, tea, all the rest. It would serve as a marketplace. And basically, it's India that allowed England to dominate the world for about 150 years. Now, by the way, all of the other Europeans would learn this lesson, and that's how Africa would be conquered, as well as a good chunk of Southeast Asia. Local deals, manipulating events, slowly get more and more grants of rights. So the notion that the Europeans were colonizers was so off base. What the Europeans did is they made business deals with locals willing to do business with them. Because as I'm sure we all know, at the end of the day, it's all about the vengeance. Questions?
Why did it take so long for the British to get that cool green section at the bottom of the
video? Down here? Well, part of the reason why was the political system that was down there. They had a very clearly defined Hindu system of government. They had a relatively strong economy and a strong military force. And if I was to overlay the map of the Mughals itself only got down to about there. So even the Muslims couldn't conquer. But given time and given enough money, eventually you'll get it too.
And that's what they did.
Good question, thank you. Any other questions? All right, well, we know that the British and the Dutch made their empires because of business. Was there an effort to do in Asia what was done in the New World? Yeah. They would attempt to convert the heathens to the true religion. But truth be told, it wasn't equal and it wasn't applied universally. One of the reasons why is that the Dutch and the English, by the time they got over to the Asian trade network, had already converted to Protestantism. The Dutch were Calvinists, and the British were Anglicans, which in part is based on Calvinism. Those two faiths, or generally speaking, don't engage in missionary work. They don't send out people to convert the masses. Because, as I said last class, one of the core components of Calvinism is the notion of predestination. You can't come into the church. You have to be born into the church. So the English and the Dutch, they weren't interested in converting. They just wanted to do business. They didn't care if you were a Muslim, or if you were an Arab, or if you were a Jew, or whatever. If you would do business with them, they would do business with you. But that's not true with the Portuguese and the Spanish. They were Catholics. And from the 16th century up until the 19th century, they would make efforts to spread Catholicism into Asia. Unfortunately, they really weren't successful. Now, granted, they wiped out the Aztec and the Incas and the Mayans, all that native religion. Gone. Purged it. But in Asia, they really didn't make much inroads. Because Islam was already there. Islam had arrived and had taken out positions out on the islands and in Southeast Asia in the 12th century. So Muslims aren't going to convert to Catholicism, generally speaking, because Muslims acknowledge Jesus as a prophet, just not as the Son of God. And truth be told, there are rules in Islam that make it very dangerous for anyone to convert to a new religion. You'll be labeled as an apostate, and Muslims will have a legal right to kill you. So most people don't go from Muslim to Christian. The same is true of the religious faith in India. The Hindu faith is literally twice as old as Christianity. The earliest evidence of Hinduism dates back to around 1800 BC. And it's a complicated faith. It's interesting. But one of the things that I find most fascinating about it is you don't necessarily have holy days of obligation. You don't have to go to church. You don't even have to really pray if you don't want to. But rather, Hinduism is based on a bargain for exchange. You basically make offerings to the gods, and they're polytheistic. And if you can give the gods the right things, the gods may act on your behalf. So you could worship one god, you could worship no gods, you could worship 20 gods. Basically, it's up to you, based on your circumstances. So when the Catholic missionaries came in and they started pushing this, most of the people were like, wait, why am I only going to worship one god? That makes no sense. Plus, even though the M's cut off. Hindu society was very rigid and structured based on what today we call the caste system. You would be stuck for your entire life in a class that you were born in. Generally, there were three major castes. You would be born a noble, an upper level of society. You would be born a commoner, or you would be born in a subcaste, the equivalent of a slave. No rights, no privileges. And there were concrete walls of separation in those castes. So if you were born of one caste system, you could not have relations with somebody else. You could not work your way out of a caste. So as the old saying goes, if dad was a ditch digger, you were going to be a ditch digger. And you could only associate with other ditch diggers. Because the priests maintained it. So, here's the irony. When the Catholic missionaries, Jesuits, first arrived, they didn't understand it. So they would try. One of the first Jesuits to arrive was none other than Francis Xavier. He arrived, and he did have some success converting people in the port villages. But he really was only able to convert thousands of poor people. The people who were in the lower castes. The people who, because of their birth, had no right of social promotion. He had no success in anyone in the middle or the upper castes. Because if you were born a noble, why would you embrace Christianity? Because let's be honest, Christianity really, really emphasizes not only equality, but also it focuses on taking care of those who are in need. Well, if you were born a noble and you lived in a palace and you had servants and you could eat all the food, drink all the wine you wanted, why would you want to worship that god? But the more interesting Jesuit was Robert de Nobly. After learning of Xavier's failures, unable to go bottom up, Robert de Nobly would attempt to go top down. So maybe he could convert some of the upper caste, and they could use their influence to spread the faith downward. But to do so, he had to learn the language. So he goes, he learned several of the spoken languages and the written languages, including Sanskrit. He began reading the Hindu texts and started finding commonalities. He also started wearing the clothes of the Hindu priests. He would go so far as to become a vegetarian. Essentially, what happened to him is he started becoming assimilated into the Hindu culture. Well, none of the people in the upper castes even considered converting, but they liked talking to him, particularly once he started speaking their language. But unfortunately for de Nobly, word reached the Pope that you have this Catholic priest not trying to spread the faith, acting like a Hindu. He ordered him to be recalled, and he was forbidden from preaching ever again. they would fail in other places. But one of the areas they had the greatest success was the Spanish, when they went to the Philippines. One of the reasons why is that the Philippines had no Buddhism or Hinduism or Islam. The vast majority of people in the Philippines were still worshiping their primitive pagan religion, engaging in human sacrifice. So when the Spanish launched its major missionary operation, it basically engaged in the same tactics that it did in the New World. So soldiers came over with the priests with them. And then once the island was conquered, the priests would stay. The priests would work on conversions as well as being a government agent, just like they were doing in the New World. And the friars in the Philippines were successful in doing talk down. They talked to the Filipino leaders. They brought the gospel. They got them hooked on the stories. And soon as the chiefs converted, they ordered all of their people to follow. In the town squares across the islands, churches were made. Mass was held. And Catholicism spread. But what created is one of the most interesting forms of Catholicism in the world. Because what allowed the friars to be successful is they realized there were some cultural traditions that could not be erased. For instance, all Asian cultures engage in ancestor worship. They remember their parents, their grandparents, their great-grandparents, going back generations. They make offerings to keep the ancestors' spirits happy and healthy. That practice still remains today. The Filipinos also engaged in ritual drinking. They would have drinking ceremonies in which they would gather together and just drink large quantities of alcohol. Well, if you're a Catholic, you really, really shouldn't be getting shit-faced. Because if you're intoxicated, you may do bad things. Bad things are a sin. Well, the friars basically said, let them drink. They also still do, they have public bathing ceremonies, where the entire village on any given day will go down to a river or a lake and everyone will jump in to try to clean the bad energy, the bad karma away. I've never done that mass before. But as a result of allowing those differences, and there are many, many others, you can do a Google search and find them. Filipinos are some of the most devout Catholics in the world. So much so, you have opportunity this year, if you remember, come Easter, to see one of the strongest examples of devotional faith in the Catholic world. Every year around Easter, Filipino men, true believers, will allow themselves to be crucified in memory of Jesus. Some allow themselves to get nailed to the cross as a sign of their faith. Does that happen anywhere down in South America, Central America? It doesn't happen in my Catholic Church. I don't know what anyone in town would say, yeah, nail me to a cross. Again, if you have a faith and it's strong and it's your own, you own it more. Well, that's a good thing, beautiful thing. Questions?
Yeah.
All right, I think this is that it for the exam. All right, well, I suppose while I'm getting the next one fired up, this where I'm going to pick up will not be on the exam. I guess I'll go to everyone who came late. As a reminder, you will have your first exam tomorrow. You should have gotten an email from me. Came announcement through Engage. The exam will open up at 8 o'clock. Give me an hour. Take the exam, and we'll cover everything up until the religious stuff. Since day one. And of course, as I said to everybody, just a warning, make sure you're in a place that has good Wi-Fi. Because if your Wi-Fi connection gets severed, you can't go back in. You'll be locked out. You'll have to do the exam all over again. All right. So where are we going from here? For exam two, we're going to stay in the part of the world that we finished in. We're going to stay in Asia. And we're going to deal with China first, then Japan, and then we'll deal with the Muslim empires. All right. The problem is I can start our class in 1500 like we're supposed to, because in Western civilization, 1492, you know, it's a big year. It's 1500 when they went out and conquered the world, or started to. But that doesn't work everywhere else on Earth. So for China, we're going to have to go back a little further, and we're actually going to start in the 1340s. Not that the time is important. But what was going on is what makes the 1340s important. The ruling dynasty, the Yuan dynasty, was in its death throes. What's a dynasty?
The warriors.
No. What's a dynasty?
A civilization that's been striving for a long time.
How? With what?
Money.
Nope. Nope, nope, no,
land,
no,
women,
yeah. No,
military success,
no, a family. A dynasty refers to a period of time, kingdom, empire, when one family was in charge. So the Yuan dynasty refers to a period of time when a succession of family was in charge of almost all of modern China. By the way, the Yuan dynasty was just another dynasty in a long line of dynasties. But the most interesting thing about the Yuan dynasty is that it was not a Chinese dynasty. But rather, it was a dynasty established when the grandson of the great Khan, Genghis Khan, who was Kublai Khan, finally did something his grandfather was unable to do. He breached the Great Wall and spread the hordes throughout China, toppling the dynasty that was in power and establishing him and his successors on the throne. But as powerful as the Mongolians were, they suffered problems similar to every single dynasty that had ever ruled China. These included, but were not limited to, natural disasters, famines, invasions, corruption, peasant uprisings. They also suffered from a series of weak emperors, which also coincidentally happened to all the dynasties. Very strong at the beginning, but really pathetically weak at the end. So, As Chinese history shows, weak emperors are destined to fall, to be replaced by someone else who takes over the throne and starts a new dynasty. All of Chinese history is nothing but the rise and fall of dynasty after dynasty after dynasty. And one of the most fascinating things is what happens is identical over and over and over again, which is proof positive that if you don't know history, you're doomed to repeat it. Although, ironically, even if you do know history, sometimes you're doomed to repeat it, because history always repeats itself. So here's how it works. Think of it like a clock. In around midnight, a new dynasty emerges victorious. They've overthrown the old dynasty, they take control of the capital, they defeat their enemies, and they impose their will upon the land. And they do all of the things that good rulers do. Most importantly, they bring peace. They also do the infrastructure stuff. They build roads, they build bridges, they fix the wall, they dredge the canals to allow the people to move and do business, to get the economy going. And as the revenue comes in, the army is strong, and the people are protected from crime, from violence, and everything is good. From about midnight to 3, the conqueror gives way to the sun, who gives way to the sun, who gives way to the sun. Typically, the first 3 to 4 emperors are like the founder. They're strong, they're focused, they're capable. And they expand the empire. They build. But typically, around the 5th or the 6th or the 7th, they kind of hit a plateau. They're no longer growing, but they're not really falling. They're just kind of like mid. Why is this? Well, it's the same truism that happens with family businesses. The grandfather who starts the business works his ass off. He sacrifices. He gives his blood, sweat, and tears to the business. Does everything to make it grow. Fortunately, the son was there and saw all the sacrifices father made. So when the torch passes, the son usually does well. Not as good as the father, or the grandfather, but still pretty good. But then, typically around the 3rd generation, the grandson, or maybe the great-grandson or daughter, when they take over, they were born after the company was founded. They don't know what it took to build the company. They take it for granted. They think it's always been here. It always will be. So they don't work as hard as the grandfather. They don't go out and try to get new products and services or new customers. They're simply happy to show up. But then eventually, they start hiding in the office. They start spending time playing solitaire. Maybe they get hooked on some substance, alcohol or drugs. They got the money, who cares? But what eventually begins to happen is the business begins to peter out. To the point where it hits that bankrupt level in that it's gone. So many little family businesses have come and gone. Well, the dynastic circle is just like that, except on a larger scale. The first couple of emperors, big, powerful, strong. But then you get to those guys that are like, yeah, okay. But then, the new dynasty starts getting old. And you get to the 7th, the 8th, the 9th ruler. And they don't know what it took to build the empire. They think the empire will always be there. And they just enjoy being the emperors. So they live in golden palaces, eat the finest foods, drink the finest wines. They have concubines, hundreds of women in pleasure palaces. They do drugs. And they allow others to rule the empire in their name. That's when around 5 o'clock, getting to around 6 o'clock, the bad times begin. Corruption. The appointed governors don't rule in the emperor's name. They rule for their own good. They take money off the taxpayers, put it into their own pocket. And then all of the government bureaucrats all throughout the country start doing the same thing. They stop enforcing the laws. They stop raising the revenue necessary to maintain the system. So soldiers start not getting paid. Bridges stop being repaired. Canals start filling up with debris. But the government needs more revenue to sustain itself. So instead of looking for the waste, they raise taxes. And in China, the only people who paid taxes were the poor people. So the people who are already struggling began being squeezed. Lose everything. Well, in the Chinese mind, this is the point where the dynasty has proved itself to be worthless. In the mind of the Chinese, they lost the mandate of heaven, which I will talk about subsequently. Well, the moment that happens, essentially they believe that the gods have turned their back on the rulers. Well, how do you know when the gods have turned their back on the rulers? Bizarrely, that's when all the natural disasters begin. Around the same time when the regime is corrupt and rotting, earthquakes, floods, storms, warfare erupts. Chaos ensues, and there's nothing the government can do about it. Well, eventually, out of the chaos, comes a new warlord, believing in law and order and justice, and will begin basically conquering the country. To the point where 12 o'clock comes around, they remove the dead emperor, the dead dynasty, put his bum on the throne, and take charge. That's what Kublai Khan did. He came in just as the previous dynasty. I think it was the Song Dynasty. I don't remember. So many Chinese dynasties. But they were basically rotting and decaying. They couldn't basically control the country. So the Mongols swept the lands, took over, and Kublai Khan took the throne and declared himself to essentially be a Chinese emperor. But fast forward 120 years, and his descendants had become lazy, incompetent, corrupt. And the dynasty was beginning to fall. Then in the 1340s, widespread peasant uprisings would begin gaining steam, and before long, by the 1350s, all of China has descended into a revolution. Questions? Well, it's at this time that a warlord appeared. And his name was Zhu Xuanzang. Zhu Xuanzang. Now, Jude was an interesting figure. He actually was not a noble. He was born a peasant and suffered greatly under the Mongol control of China. His parents literally would lose the farm. They were kicked off. They became homeless. And then shortly thereafter, a plague erupted in China. Possibly the bubonic plague. Not quite sure. But his parents and both of his brothers died. Leaving him, I think he was like 8 years old. Orphaned. All alone. He soon made his way into some urban centers and somehow survived, engaging in begging, little petty crimes, little pickpocketing. Sometimes he would go to Buddhist monasteries and get sanctuary just to get a warm meal. But he managed not to die, as so many in his circumstances would. Then, in the 1340s, a rebellion broke out in his province. Zhu decided, well, I got nothing to live for, I got nothing to lose, so he joined one of the rebel bands, a group called the Red Turbans. And soon he began proving himself on the battlefield. Courage, bravery, natural leadership all appeared, allowing him to rise to the top of the Red Turbans, eventually taking it over as their commander. He would manage to take his entire province from the Yuan, making himself like a warlord. And then once he took one, he did the same thing in the neighboring province, in the next province, in the next province. And after 3 decades, 30 years of constant fighting, he seized the Chinese capital, threw out the Yuan, and declared himself emperor. Now, for those of you who know nothing about Chinese culture, the emperors, when they take the throne, take throne names. The throne name is supposed to be a reflection of how they intend to rule. Zhu Yuancheng chose his throne name, Hong Wu. Hong Wu means warlike ruler. He basically is telling his empire, he built it through war, he will maintain it through war. Almost done, and I will let you go early, like I said. He also claimed this mandate of heaven, which I referred to previously. The mandate of heaven is a unique element of Chinese custom. It is a belief that the heaven is a deity, but it's not an anthropomorphic deity. Meaning, it can't take physical shape. It doesn't take the form of a human being or an animal. It's kind of like the Force in Star Wars. And the heaven essentially requires a fit ruler to rule over Earth. So, if you are successful in conquering and taking the throne, you can basically declare, I did it with heaven's blessing. He has received a mandate. This requires good justice. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to be a pushover. Doesn't mean you're going to be nice and hold everyone's hands. No, you bring law and order. You bring justice. So long as you do that, no one can legally challenge you. But it's not like what they had in Europe. In Europe, the European kings claimed kind of the same thing. They claimed, well, God wants me to be king. Because if God didn't want me to be king, I wouldn't be king. The difference is in Europe, the European kings could use this divine rights to basically charge people with treason if they challenge their rule. Because what right do you as a human being have to question God's judgment? The mandate is not the same. The mandate is revocable. It can be revoked. So just because you get the mandate of heaven, if you come onto the throne and you're incompetent, if you're an idiot, if you do not bring justice, the heavens will basically take the mandate away. And as I said during the dynastic circle, you know the mandate's lost when Mother Nature wreaks havoc. There's your proof that the heavens are not pleased. So, if you rule well, you keep it. If you rule poorly, a coup d'etat, a revolution, is justified. In fact, the gods want it to happen. Questions on that? So long story short, takes the throne, declares he has the mandate of heaven, and he would found a dynasty that would become known as the Ming Dynasty.
We'll pick up with the Ming stuff on Thursday.
This is not on tomorrow's exam. Tomorrow's exam stops with the religious takeover of the Philippines. All right, so if you are one of the guys that came late, make sure you listen to the lecture. I'll try to get them up in 2 hours when I get home. Because I talk about not only tomorrow's exam, but I also talk about your paper. If you have any questions, send me an email tonight. I'll do my best to check. And if not, I'll get back to you tomorrow. And lastly, do not forget to take the exam. You have until midnight to get it done. You've missed two. This is your third. One more, you're going to stop losing points. Tuesday. Check. Tuesday. Check. Exam number one. Tomorrow. There you go, my friend. All right, next up. This is me. Check, check. Exam number one. Tomorrow. There you go. Next. Take one down, pass it around. Global history. This is me. L-I-M-A-N-E-K. Tuesday. Yeah, you were here on time. Actually, I should have dung some of the football guys. They came late. Yeah, whatever. Exam. One. Tomorrow. This is not a good, even work surface.
Thank you.
There you go. Yep, got it. Next. All right. Where am I? Down here. L-I-M-A-N-E-K. There we go, there we go. Exam number one. I feel like I've written this 10 times. Because I have like 10 football.
Thank you.
Yeah, well,
see my other class. One of my other classes, it's like the whole class is football players. We we go up to the teacher and every class, and it's just like, it's crazy.
Well, if it gets too crazy, I'll get my notary stamp and start notarizing.
Yeah, right?
Boom, boom, boom.